Attention, attention. Achtung, Achtung. Endach, Endach. At Incio and Incio. Please stand by for an important announcement. Hi, my name's Roger Kugler. This is Working at Woodworking Podcast, episode number 97. Tips and tricks and the future of working at woodworking. I'm here to help you on your journey from moving from a weekend warrior, an amateur woodworker, an enthusiast, to a professional woodworker. You have skills that you have cultivated over years or months that you can share with your community. Somebody, someplace, has something that needs to be fixed, and that somebody to fix it could be you. Okay, big announcement. Okay, number one, I beg forgiveness for butchering the four most popular languages used to listen to working at woodworking. Hey, I'm trying my best here. So, big announcement, I'm quitting. Yep, that's it. Podcast over. Done. Finis. Kaput. Well, okay, technically I'm not quitting. I'm taking an extended break, probably through most of the summer. Why? Well, number one, I am super busy right now. I have several jobs that are all on a collision course for the same deadline, and unless I really get my butt in gear, I am not going to meet any of the deadlines. I have a house to remodel that's been going, well, slowly. I have several canoes that are, well, like due yesterday. So I've cut back on all my other work. I haven't taken on any new build jobs, you know, cabinets, bookcases, things like that for, honestly, it's been a couple years. Repair work, I have, well, I've not taken on any more than I couldn't get out of. I have a really hard time saying no. I don't know if you suffer from that ailment, but it can really get you in a bind sometimes. I have been putting off a whole bunch of jobs for a long time, which means they're coming due pretty soon. So I'm just going to take a break, get some of these things knocked out. And really the second reason, I think I've pretty much beaten this dead horse. Okay, that probably didn't come out right to some of you. Beating a dead horse, that's an expression that's used in the U.S. and maybe other locations in which the job's done. Just move on. I think I have pretty much said everything that I and my feeble brain could come up with to get you over the hump from moving from I really love woodworking to actually making some money at woodworking. If you haven't figured it out by now, I don't know if I can be a whole bunch more help to you. I'm not going to take a break after this episode. I actually do want to make it to 100, so there's four more episodes out there. And I do want to maybe revisit credit card usage, because since the last time I talked about this was like back in episode 24 or something, there have been some changes that I think you should know about. Maybe I'll revisit a website building, because this is the mountain I'll die on. You really need a website. I don't care what you're doing. And there's another little twist to that I would really like to drive home. Social media, yeah, I suck at it, but honestly, I kind of choose to suck at it. We'll maybe throw all these into one episode about your web presence. And tell me what you have questions on, please. They've kind of dried up a little bit. I've had several communiques on how I've helped people start their business, and I really appreciate those. I mean, I can hear the enthusiasm in your emails, and I just absolutely love that. So if you have anything on your mind, any questions, you know, need a little bit of help, please shoot me something and we'll get this, get that worked into the last upcoming four episodes. So that takes care of half of today's episode, and let's move on to tips and tricks. These have always been popular. It's really kind of surprised me. To me, this is a way of putting out an episode when I don't really have something that I've researched and really spent hours, you know, writing out a script and put together. I have a way of taking notes, which we'll talk about, that I just accumulate these things and I can just kind of throw them together and it's kind of easy for me. And wow, the numbers, you know, the downloads really, really take off. So I appreciate that. So tips and tricks. Number one, I should have known this. This almost could be a boy, was I stupid segment. Folding wood. What do I mean by this? I make a product that the final dimension and width is 3 5/8 inches. And when you buy lumber, random width, random length, which typically is the cheapest way you can buy hardwood lumber, oftentimes I get a board that is 6 3/4 inches wide, which is wonderful, but I only rough that out at about 4 inches. Then I can, you know, straight line it and continue the milling process. So I have some scrap left over, and some of the wood, which is not terribly expensive, well, it honestly goes to the burn pile. But other wood, particularly walnut right now, and white oak is getting right up there with it. Yeah, no, I hate burning that because it is so freaking expensive. So what do you do? Well, I save all those offcuts and then I glue them up. And of course, my lumber supplier was running short on walnut. And of course, I just got a flurry of orders for the walnut product that I make. And it's like, what am I going to do? I don't have enough walnut to get this done. Let me go through all of my scrap to see what I can glue up. And I was able to do a pretty good job grain matching and color matching the walnut because I hate to stain. I really just don't like to stain. Before I will stain walnut, I will tone walnut. And what I mean by that is I buy Mohawk Lacquer Toner. These are rattle can, you know, spray paint cans. They cost like $8, $9. And it has lacquer, dyed lacquer in it. And so I can take that dyed lacquer, incredibly fine spray, and I can hit one little area of the wood that might be a little too light and darken that to get it to kind of blend in. I'm not trying to match, but I'm just trying to get it to blend in a little better. And it's lacquer, which means, yes, I know, I hate lacquer. But for this particular case, it's so easy. And it dries so quickly. And it's completely compatible with the shellac finish that I use. It just makes life easy. If you're not familiar with the Mohawk Toners, please check that out. You can go to their website. There's various places you can buy this. Like I said, it's not terribly expensive. But I'll use that instead of stain, because when you put stain on, you stain the entire thing, and you don't have a whole bunch of control over it, and you basically make, particularly with walnut, you make it darker and more muddy. You just lose a lot of that grain detail, where with the toner, you're not. Okay, that's my 2 cents. So I came down, I needed literally one more piece of walnut to be able to complete this project and complete the order. I had a long piece, but it was very narrow. I don't know, sometimes my brain just doesn't work very well, because I finally realized, if I cut this long piece in half and folded it, like from the middle where I cut it, and just fold the ends together, now I have a wide piece. And OMG, the grain pattern. Wow. Basically, what I was doing is I was book matching the grain by cleaving the board in half lengthwise and then folding it back together and then gluing it. I've been doing this for like over 50 years. I am sure that I read this technique someplace, or I watched a YouTube video about this technique, or back in the day, VHS tapes. But for some reason, it just never really clicked. And I did that, and I had a beautiful piece of wood. I mean, this is actually going to be the featured piece on the project. It was wonderful. So, I don't know, maybe you have brain farts like that you know, take a crisis to break through. And I know that there's probably some of you saying, oh, I really hate gluing wood together. Yeah, I feel your pain. I really do. That's just our modern world that we live in. We're not buying, you know, walnut boards that are 28 inches wide anymore. That's just not going to happen. And you really do need to get very good at gluing boards together if you're going to survive, you know, in a professional capacity. Well, honestly, even an amateur capacity in woodworking, because it's just like a daily part of the process. A couple tips for gluing boards together. Parallel clamps. There, I said it. I know, your pocketbook just screamed a little bit. They are expensive, but they're worth it. They really are. These things are going to last a lifetime. And no, I don't have a favorite. I have several Bessie clamps that I think are very, very good. I also have some Jorgensen clamps, the orange ones, that honestly, I really like them. They are heavy. And I've heard good things about the Harbor Freight parallel clamps. I mean, on YouTube, so it's got to be true. You know, not all that terribly expensive. And, you know, for the money, I've heard that they're not bad at all. So do some research and just bite the bullet. I mean, it is a major piece of woodworking equipment in your shop to have a nice set of parallel bar clamps. How many? I think a minimum of 3. You can do 2 on the bottom, and that's going to give you a good base to start laying your boards in, and then 1 on top in the middle to kind of push everything down and keep the boards from, you know, curling one way or the other. And remember, if your board kind of curls up, kind of humps up in the middle, that's not necessarily an error in you jointing the edges. That could be an error of your clamps, because unless those 2 jaws of the clamps are not absolutely perfectly parallel, if they're off just a half a degree, it's going to induce that hump in your glue up, and you have to use a cawl or something like that to push that down and flatten that out. So if your clamps eliminate that to begin with, your clamping life, that sounds weird, it will be just so much easier and better. Now, the edges sometimes will ride up, and I use F-style clamps to just kind of crush the edges down so that they're nice and even all the way around. Sometimes you could use biscuits as an alignment tool, especially if it's a great big table or something like that that you're gluing up. You could use the Festool Domino, although I think that's a little overkill, you know, for this type of application. Now, here's the big thing. If you need boards that are 4 inches wide and you're having to cut that from a 7-inch wide board, here's a tip. Don't plane the 7-inch wide board down to your final thickness. No. Cut out the 4-inch board from the rough 7-inch board, and then only plane down your 4-inch wide board, the one that you're going to use. Leave the cutoff thick so that when you do glue the cutoffs together, you have a lot of thickness that you can work with. And if the edges are not, you know, perfectly flush, that's fine because, you know, three or four passes through the planer, they will be flush. It took me a little while to figure that one out too. Like I say, I'm not necessarily the brightest bulb in the pack. If you sell products on Etsy, and if your products have options where people can add this on or add that on, it can come this way or it can come that way. Here's a little helpful hint for you. I kind of got myself into a bind where I had a customer order an item from me, and then like 3 days later, she convoed me and said, could I add this option? Well, yes, sure. And so I created a special order, a custom order for her, in which she paid for that option. I made the product. I shipped the product with the option included. Everything was good. Whenever I generated the shipping label, that told Etsy that I had shipped the product, and so I was a good little boy and shipped the product within the window that I said I would ship the product, so they gave me a star, and that really helps in your search engine results on Etsy if somebody is looking for your particular product. You want all the help you can get, so you want that star seller status. But I was on there like a week later checking on something, and I saw that I had an overdue order. Ah! How did this happen? Etsy never picked up the fact that the custom order was part of the original order. And honestly, the algorithm wouldn't know any better. There's no way of linking those two. But the option was dinged as a late ship. So, you know, I kind of got my hands slapped. So in the future, if you have to add on these, you know, any custom items or something like that, make sure you go in and manually indicate that that add-on item has been shipped at the same time that the product is shipped. So I learned that one the hard way. Have you been feeling a little burned out, maybe overwhelmed, frustrated, indecisive, maybe just a bit wishy-washy? Should I start a business? Should I not start a business? No, this is not an advertisement for a coaching call with me, although it could be a good advertisement. I'm actually referring to Paul Seller's video blog number 19. Link in the show notes. Paul Sellers, as many of you probably follow, is a wonderful Englishman who has been doing this for a very long time. And he did a little video blog, you know, kind of sharing things about his life. And I found it just to be very inspiring. You know, he's demonstrating how he carves a spoon while he talks about kind of his woodworking journey, you know, in his professional career as a woodworker. And I just thought it was very good. It really kind of put things in perspective. One of the things he kind of focused on was his role as a teacher and the various places that he has taught and the various types of students that he has taught. I think you should watch it. I think you would gain some insights from it. And if you have any bent whatsoever as far as teaching, that's something I cannot encourage you more to do. Are you the greatest woodworking teacher in the world? No. Are you the greatest woodworking teacher in your state or country? Probably not, especially if you're listening to this podcast. Are you the greatest woodworking teacher in your community? Yeah, very likely. You know, the competition may not be all that intense, but if you know more about woodworking than your student knows about woodworking, well, then that makes you the woodworking expert to that student. And that's all you really need to introduce someone to this wonderful world we call woodworking. So if you've been thinking about doing that, take the plunge. Do it. Tip number, I have no idea. Propane in a paint can. What could possibly go wrong? Now, a lot of you know that one of my jobs is working on antique wooden canoes, which means that I have to paint these antique wooden canoes. And I am the very first person to admit I am not a painter. I don't really like to paint. I have vinyl siding on my house, and I'm okay with that. Why? I don't have to paint it. But I do want to do a good job on my canoes, and I will also admit I'm not the best canoe painter in the world. I've been working at it. This one I'm working on right now, I can honestly say is the best one I have ever done, because I can be taught. One of the things that I learned was that with oil-based paints, which is what I use on canoes, which is dominant in the marine industry, not so in the housing industry, at least in the U.S., is that when you open a can of paint and expose it to oxygen, that paint will start to cure. It cures through oxygen chemical reaction. So let's say you use half a quart of paint and you put the lid back on and you come back in a month, 2 months, a year, and you open up the can and there's this skin on top of, well, in essence, cured paint. How do you prevent that? Well, in one of my boat building books, the author suggested grab your propane torch, open it up, flood the can, and then put the lid on it. Okay, sure, I'll try that. I'll try anything once. And you know, it works. I did that to a can that I had opened August of 2023. And I got a little smarter in that I started to buy my paint in the gallon cans instead of the quart cans, because number one is cheaper, and number two, Kirby Paints out of Massachusetts, not sponsored, was offering free shipping on this. It's like, okay, I don't need a gallon of red. I only need a quart, maybe two. So I went ahead and bought a gallon. I took that gallon, went to the hardware store, and I'd bought 4-quart paint cans, just plain steel paint cans. And I transferred the gallon into those 4 quarts, put a little bit of propane in each one, sealed it. The half-empty can that I opened up recently was absolutely pristine, other than that little whiff of propane that came off of it. It worked really, really well. If you don't like playing around with propane, some people have suggested argon, but if you've gone to a welding supply house lately and priced argon, OMG, is it expensive. And actually, they suggested nitrogen. Nitrogen's not that expensive, considering it makes up, like, I don't know, 78% of our atmosphere. So that would work. Also, you can do this yourself. You know that we breathe in air, which is a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen and a few other things, and we breathe out CO2, carbon dioxide. And I have done this technique, and I can say it does work, maybe not for a year, but I will hold my breath, suck out all the oxygen I can, let that CO2 build up in the lungs, and then exhale into the paint can and quickly seal the lid. I know, that's the weirdest thing you have heard today, maybe even this week, but it works for me. I mean, I can open the can up in six months, and just the CO2 added, treated can, no skim, nothing. I was watching Stumpy Nubs the other day. He was on YouTube. He was talking about safety, hand injuries. You know that a little while ago he had a very nasty encounter with a Lancelot blade on a diagonal grinder, did not end well for him. And he talked about one of the problems he had was that he was wearing a titanium ring. And the hospital actually couldn't get the ring off. They had nothing to cut through that titanium. And after his hand is absolutely mangled by this tool, when he got home, his finger was swelling, and he was afraid that if he didn't get that ring off, he'd end up losing the finger, or the finger would deglove, which, look that up on your own. I'm not going to describe it. So he went out to his shop with his bandaged, mangled hand and actually cut his titanium ring off, which the purpose of the video was to encourage people not to wear metal rings. Now, a gold ring is a little softer, and it probably would have been removed by the angle grinder. It's relatively soft. But he was really advocating silicon rings. You've all seen them. They're usually black, and sometimes there are different colors that you can get. And men, you know, there's these, you know, male models who are modeling, doing manly things wearing these silicon rings. I think they're a real good idea. I actually bought a set last year, but they're just so wide. You got to remember, I have these short little sausage fingers, and it just was not comfortable at all for me. But I've wanted to wear a ring. I wear my ring whenever, you know, I go out with my wife, formal, you know, occasions. But yeah, it'd still be nice to have something, you know, to wear, you know, everyday wear, everyday carry. I was in a hardware store last week, and I was walking by the O-rings. Remember, I got these short little sausage fingers. So I opened up the case for the O-rings. I tried on a 16th by 11 16ths. That was a little tight. Then I tried on a 1/8 by 3/4. That was fit nice, but it was bulky. So then I found a 16th inch by 3/4 O-ring and slipped that on. It was just like our wedding day. That fits so nicely. It's so comfortable. And if I should happen to, you know, come into an unfortunate encounter with a diagonal grinder, it's not going to rip my finger off. Oh, and the best part? 69 cents. Yeah, there we go. Yep, can't say I'm not a big spender. Shop productivity. We've actually done a episode on this. Can't remember when. But how do you get things done in the shop, in your shop office? There are all kinds of schemes. I talked about the Eisenhower matrix, which, honestly, I do use that, and it has been helpful to me. But I came across something the other day that really has kind of been almost a godsend to me. Spiral-bound notebook. Yes, that's right. One spiral-bound notebook to rule them all. I know you're sitting there, you get a phone call, and it's Mrs. Smith wanting you to repair her rocking chair, and you scrounge around for a piece of paper, or sometimes even a piece of wood to write her name and number down, and then what happens? Yeah, you lose the piece of paper. I have lost jobs because I couldn't find the piece of paper that I wrote this down on. So no more. That's not going to happen. I have a large 8.5 by 11 spiral bound notebook, a grid notebook that I keep out in the shop for, you know, doing quick sketches and things like that on. But I also have a small, it's like 6.5 by 10 inch spiral bound notebook that I keep at my desk in the shop. This is where I write down anything that needs to be written down. No more salesman sample little notepads, you know, that they hand out, that you tear a sheet out and then it goes someplace into the great abyss. No. If it's important, it needs to get written in the small spiral bound notebook. That's it. End of story. No other options. I haven't lost a phone number, a job contact, anything. It has been, well, it's literally been a game changer for me. So if you suffer from the same malady, I would really encourage you just to have one place that you take notes. I know some people use their cell phones. I don't always have my cell phone with me. And even if I did have my cell phone with me, there's a real strong possibility that I would lose it in my cell phone. So this one little notebook, this is what I'm using now. And speaking of productivity, if you're one of the people who use Gmail, which I hope that you have a yourname@yourcompany.com email address, not, 12745bozo@aol.com. That is not a good email address for somebody who's in the woodworking profession, or really any profession for that matter. But my work email, roger@workingatwoodworking.com, gets forwarded to my Gmail account. So I have everything right there, one place. I know I'm the product. They're tracking me. I've gotten over it. Gmail offers tasks. If you look over in the far right-hand column, there's a little button down there that when you hover over it, it pops up and says task. This is your checklist. This is your notepad. This is where you can keep notes on your computer, not things that would go into your spiral-bound notebook. And I can type out what I'm going to do today. In fact, I can list my jobs that I've been working on or my task that I've been working on. And I even break it down into today, tomorrow, this week, this month, going back to the Eisenhower matrix. And I can move things around. In fact, I even break it down to AM and PM, what I'm going to do in the morning, what I'm going to do in the afternoon. This has worked beautifully for me. Finally, I'm getting all those cobwebs and sawdust in my brain to line up at attention and to get in order so that I can operate through my day in somewhat of a logical sequence. So just something I'm throwing out there. Might help you. And speaking of Eisenhower matrix, the other thing that I have adopted, although I think this was from Coverly, 3 things a day. I put 3 things on my today list. No more, no less. If I can get those 3 things done, it has been a very successful day. And you got to be reasonable, like build a new shop would not be on that today's list. Although, if you were building a new shop, you might say complete site plan for the building department. That would be something that you could do in one day as far as that project goes. So, 3 things a day, Gmail task, everything written goes into one spiral-bound notebook. I've encouraged you to get on as many databases as you can for your woodworking business. And I think I have mentioned Thomas.net. Thomas is it's at least a century old company that I think they started up around the 1860s or so in Europe. It was a kind of a who's who in business book. In fact, it was like more of an encyclopedia because it was huge. And companies would pay to get into the Thomas registry. And so if you were in business and you needed a XYZ, you could go to the Thomas volume XYZ and see who made XYZs in your area, and you could set up a business arrangement with them. Well, the internet has changed a lot of that, but Thomas registry has adopted in the form of Thomas.net. And so you can go there and register your business for free. Yes, they will try to sell you things, but for free. And you can list your specialties. I had an inquiry from Ireland wanting to know if I would build this particular project. And no, I appreciate the you reaching out, but I cannot do that at this time. just an example that when you put yourself out there, you have no idea where it could lead. So check it out, thomas.net. Photos. It has occurred to me that people do not read. You can have the most wonderful description on Etsy or some other platform, your own website, but people will not read it. You'll get questions. Does this come in maple? Yes, it does. It says right there. Sentence number 3 comes in maple. No, people do not read. The solution? Photos. People look at photographs. They are very, very visual people. They look at photographs. So have a photograph of maple. Then you hopefully will not get those questions. It's good to get questions. Don't get me wrong. That means that that person is communicating and no sale can take place until there is communication. You communicated in your text under the description that you had maple. The customer didn't see that communication. They're just looking at pictures. So have a picture of your product in maple. Boom. You've communicated via images. Speaking of platforms that you're selling on, of course, there should be your website. And it doesn't have to be a full e-commerce website, although honestly, Squarespace makes it pretty darn easy and inexpensive to do that now. But they should at least know what you make, what services you offer, and how to get in contact with you. That is a form of communication that can lead to sales. So other platforms, of course, there's Etsy. That's probably the biggest, baddest, most hated, most productive. If you're not on Etsy, yeah, I don't think you're really trying that hard. What about Amazon? Yeah, that's the 800-pound gorilla on the internet. Amazon has a thing called Amazon Handmade, and I'll include a link. I will include a link in the show notes to an article by junglescout.com that talks about how to sell on Amazon. I have sold on Amazon. I did for years. I can't say they make it real easy. There are so many little hoops and rings of fire that you have to jump through. And honestly, they're not pushing the handmade, handcrafted items on Amazon. But we can't really say that Etsy is pushing the handmade, handcrafted items on their platform the way they promised they would when they first started up, like 15 years ago. They have kind of turned into an Amazon Lite in a lot of ways. Is it worth doing Amazon? Maybe. Check it out. There are some things they do incredibly well. There are some things that are just downright frustrating, but you can find that on Etsy also. How about eBay? I've tried eBay. I wasn't terribly successful. I had one product that did fairly well on eBay, but people just don't think of eBay when they're looking for custom woodworking items. They really don't. There's Artfire. They went out of business. Scratch that. There's Bonanza, which, if you're over a certain age, refers to a TV series, which is kind of weird to think that you're going to buy something there. I have signed up for Bonanza. I've opened an account, and to be honest with you, I've never done anything with it. Quiche is kind of the word that I think of. Kitschy. Kind of Amazonian-ish. I'm not terribly impressed with it. All right, the last thing. There is a big movement here in the U.S. with the government and the National Labor Relations Board. Are you an employee or are you a contractor? I know that countries are different and, you know, this may not affect you at all. But there's been this really big push to change or define when a person is an employee of a company and when they are a contractor for a company, an independent contractor. And, well, the government, being the government, says that they are there to help protect the people, but, well, it's government, and very often they just muck that up horribly. And so you might have a person who, he likes to paint, and there's a contractor who's building a house, and they're kind of friends with this guy that likes to paint, and it's like, hey, can you come over and paint some rooms? I'm ready to have those painted. Like, sure, I'm not doing anything this weekend. And he comes over and he knocks these rooms out and he, you know, hands them some money and thank you, I'll have these other rooms ready for you in a couple weeks or so. And he makes some extra money. It's a side gig, right? What could possibly be wrong? Well, that's where the government comes in. Was that person an employee or was that person an independent contractor? And it kind of comes down to, well, some people would say an overreach of government. Some people would say abuse of the little guy by the mega corporations. And the truth is probably someplace in the middle there. It's very possible the contractor is not following all the rules and regulations as far as the accounting and the reporting and the documentation of this buddy who just came over on a weekend and did a little bit of work and made a little bit of cash. And the guy who's doing this as a side gig may not be following all the government rules and regulations. And my theory is that our Social Security system is, well, come on, it's been basically underfunded since it was created in 1934. And the government is looking at some way of capturing that. And I know that there are people out there who do work for cash, free enterprise, capitalism, love that, but then they don't report that money. And more importantly, they don't pay taxes on that money to the government. And I think that's really what the government's trying to do, is to get every little nickel and dime that they possibly can. So if you're an independent contractor, you need to act like an independent contractor. Even though you only paint on the weekends, you still need to go through all the hoops, all the fiery hoops, you know, declaring yourself a business, filing taxes, and where the Social Security comes in is you're paying that full 15%, the employer side, which is your independent contracting business, and you, as in essence, the employee of that business that is you. So you end up paying 15%. This is the self-employment taxes, the way it shows up on your tax forms. So the government's getting really, really nitpicky about this. And if you're in a situation like that, it's kind of like fish or cut bait, you know, get off the fence because you might find yourself in a little bit of, you know, hot water. There's all kinds of stuff over the all over the internet. I would recommend you go to the actual government website. I will try to include a link in the show notes for that. This may affect some of you. Others, it may not. So take it for what it's worth. Missed jobs for this episode. I'm going to say that inquiry from Ireland. It sounded really interesting. It could be something that could be very lucrative, even though you're shipping all the way across the, you know, an ocean. But I took a big pass on it. Recommendations for this episode, I included a link to Paul Seller's video blog. Definitely check that out. And also the Amazon Handmade. Special thanks to listeners in Roberts, Wisconsin, and St. John's, Newfoundland, and Labrador. And to the one listener in France. Greatly appreciate that. If you would like to support the show, remember, there's going to be at least four more episodes. You can buy me a coffee. You can make a donation directly on working@woodworking.com. I'm always open to coaching calls. This kind of tends to be the season. And you can always catch episodes of this on YouTube now at www.youtube.com/working@woodworking. So until next episode, happy woodworking.